The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on October 28, 2007. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Sometimes I talk about the issue of shame. I don't do that very often. And it's never well received. Nobody wants to hear about it. It's difficult because the way we look at shame in Buddhist thinking is quite different than we're used to. It's considered a virtue that we have a sense of shame. But in our culture, this issue of shame has been so badly used to crush people, to make them feel less than they are, to pin people down. It's something very unhealthy. And it's very difficult for me to get across, and maybe it's just because of that word, shame. So what's behind it? I mean, what are we really talking about? We throw that label on it and well, we all get sidetracked. So I thought maybe I'd talk about this in a different way, using a term that actually we don't find so much in Buddhism, though it is there. The term itself probably isn't used so much, but what it's pointing to is there. And it's very akin to what we mean by shame in Buddhism. But this is a much more common term in the West. The term I'm thinking of is honor. Once again, that's something that for us in our time has just gone by the boards. We maybe give lip service to it, but we don't really seem to understand what this word means, what it is pointing to. What is it in us that this term honor refers to? Just like the word shame, it's been so misused. Like, for example, our current president referred to the former attorney general as an honorable man, even though it was shown that he lied to the Congress, he carried out all sorts of dishonest fananglings. And they're not upfront about it, and they're hiding it as much as possible, and all of this. This sort of thing goes on. But he was called an honorable man. So it's like once we use a term like that, under those circumstances, we've just thrown it away. It doesn't mean anything. Normally I don't want to talk about individuals, but these are public figures. And it's all out there. And I don't mean even to condemn, but just to let's look at what this is. Of course, even the president, is he an honorable man? Brought this whole nation into a war through lies, through deceit. And then he speaks of an honorable person. Well, what does it even mean? How can such a one as that even speak of honor? So what do we mean by this term? Our senators, that's how we address them, the honorable. Of course, as we look around at our senators and congressmen, are they honorable? Well, I think some are. But you see, this term, it came from a time in our history when it really meant something. The so-called founding fathers, they pledged their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor when they rebelled against the King of England and brought on the revolution. They put it all on the line, and they were up against big odds. Take a lot of courage. But they were willing to sacrifice even their lives for honor. There was a time when if people felt this way, when maybe we had at least a society in which this was a truly felt quality in human beings, then a man or a woman could give their word, to pledge their word on something. They were bound by honor to honor their word. And for them to violate this, for one who truly feels this, has this sense of honor, within them, within their own heart and mind. If you really sense that, you really feel that, you will speak truth, and when you give your word, you will abide by that. You will hold to that. Well, this is just a virtue that just simply is lacking in our society today, where even our leaders will just throw out terms like this with nothing behind it. It just sounds good. Why is this the case? This is something I want to look at. It's come on fairly quickly. Because I remember, just in the lifetime of many of us here, certainly in my lifetime, and I'm not really the oldest one here, I don't think, but wasn't it Kennedy, President Kennedy? They were going to take some kind of action or whatever. And the president said they were going to do such and such, and the president of France said, that's good enough. Well, do you want some proof of this? And he said, no, the word of the president of the United States is good enough for me. This was something that has occurred even in my life, that there was that sense that people trusted each other. When you violate that, even in your own personal life, when you violate that, it is nearly impossible to get it back. This is something that is truly precious, and it is a virtue. And it is something that you have to feel, you have to find it in your own heart and mind. And you need to live out of that. Because if you do not, you will complicate your life in such a way. And if you don't own up to it, at least within your own mind, fess up to it, you will not find this path. You will not find this way. And your life will be continuously embroiled in pain and difficulty. Whether we're talking on the personal level or on the level of our society, it's all the same. And I think people in times past, they understood this, at least better than today. Certainly, there's honorable people, no doubt as far back as human beings go. But it is a virtue, and its necessity is lost to us today. And I want to just explore that a little bit as to why that might be the case. There was a time when most of us, or many of us at least, were taught things about right and wrong, taught things about good and evil, and where we believed that there were these absolutes of good and evil. And if we believed that, if we truly believed it, we didn't just pay lip service to it, but within our own heart and mind, we really believe that there are certain things, certain standards that are good, absolutely good, and there are others that are absolutely evil. If we have any sense about that at all, then this matter of honor and keeping your word, even when no one's even going to find out about it, is going to ring true for you. It is going to speak to you. It's going to resonate within you, and you're very likely to act out of that. But when this is taken away from us, this sense of absolute rightness, wrongness, sense of absolute, then we'll lose any moral compass we might have in regards to that. Now the compass dial is just free to swing any which way, whichever way the wind is blowing. Whichever way might be advantageous for your moment right now to advance your career or to get in with this crowd or to maneuver and control the public or whatever. That becomes our bottom line. That becomes what we're working out of. And our sense of self is strengthened with that kind of view. We become more and more preoccupied with our own personal desires. feeling less and less, or maybe no compunction whatsoever, to do things that might otherwise be despicable or dishonorable or whatever. Lying, cheating, deceiving, or any number of other things. Stealing. We lose that because what is important now is that, well, we get ahead, we get our situation going. And whether we do this through diplomacy or through other means or just through might and going there. And yeah, now we're free to do that. And I'm afraid that what has happened in our society is that we've drifted into that. Because that moral compass, that sense that there is some absolute right or wrong to all of this, that is lost to us. It sort of divides us into two camps. And that's where we tend to go. There's these two extremes. And one where it would seem like, yes, well, we believe that. We'll cite some holy word or some holy book, some holy doctrine that gives us this ultimate law. And we abide by that no matter what. Even though people would say that this is the absolute, but of course, any number of people can do that, and they're not all looking at the same thing. But for each one, this is it. No, this is it. You know, and that's not a very good situation. And not only that, there's others who, first of all, they don't buy any one of those. So they don't buy into that at all. Or many others as well over here who don't think that there's anything to this. That there's no basis for this whatsoever. That it's all relative. So there we are. It's like either we do something very rigid and foolish. And it is foolish to think that we can take hold of some moral absolute here, or that we've gotten hold of it. And not only can we live according to this, and this is the right way, very often we will feel like we've got the duty now to make everybody else comply. And of course, so many of us can see what a wretched worldview that is, and we don't buy it. At least we don't buy yours. If we happen to be buying another set, though, we might be doing the very same thing and not realizing what we're doing. And all the rest of us just stand back and look at this. That's crazy. None of you have got it. In fact, I don't think there is such a thing. So we become, you know, the materialist, the concretist. It's really a misuse of that term. I know it applies to poetry, but I'm using it as just one who sees everything in just concrete terms. Now, this is a very, very sorrowful situation, but it happens to be where most of us are today, somewhere in this picture, in this scheme. But this is not what the Buddha Dharma teaches. There's something else that we can look to here that just isn't in this wretched picture at all. Well, it's there because this is in the human world. But that is seeing through it. This is almost like just sort of a false choice that we have. Between either we give up our minds and follow blindly with some system here, or it's all just, hey, it's all up for grabs. Take whatever you can get. The Buddha way points to something. It points to these two. These would be extremes. And the Buddha's teaching is the avoidance of extremes. We might think, well, but yeah, but this is it. This is the situation. There's no other alternative. Nothing else we can do about this situation. But actually, there is. This gets into some very profound subtleties here that I've talked about in many different ways. But as Nagarjuna points out, this goes right to the very heart of what the Buddha taught. Seeing this issue, the way I've characterized this age is one of many ways it could be done. Maybe this is the first time I've actually kind of laid it out in that way, but it's the same thing in so many different aspects of our life. The same thing over and over again. But we have to see this clearly, because if we do not, then we do not understand the Buddha's teaching. And this is called the distinction between these two extremes, these two wretched extremes of the relative and absolute. Now, I know in Buddhism. We talk about thoroughgoing relativity. That's what this world, this Saha world, this world of this and that, this world of birth and death, the world of you and me, or in particular for each one of us, it's the world of me and then everything else. That world, that's the relative world. And it is thoroughgoing relativity. That's the part that we don't really quite understand. We don't understand it in a number of different ways. First of all, that it's thorough. That it's just all there is. Period. Okay. Though if we happen to get that thought, we'll think, oh, well, then that's all there is. It's all relative. So we're kind of like, sounds like we're over here in this camp over here of the relativists. There's no absolute. And many people take up Buddhist teaching and they end up over there. And they think that that's what it is. They forget that Nagarjuna pointed out, well, you know, there is this distinction to be made between these two truths, relative and absolute. Why would he say that if that's all there is? Maybe this thoroughgoing relativity doesn't mean that's all there is, folks. It's all relative. There is no absolute. We're all adrift. You know, I mean, if we look at the Buddhist teaching and Buddhist practice, as it's been handed down to us by many great teachers, surely that this isn't how they're operating. That should be just a given. You should understand it. You should say, if that's what you're thinking, it's, you know, clearly there's something amiss there. Because there's plenty of great teachers over the generations that weren't acting in ways, speaking in ways that would bear that out. Quite the contrary. They must be seeing something else far more subtle than that, because it isn't really obvious what it would be. But that is what we find in the Buddhist teaching, and that there is this distinction, then, as Nagarjuna pointed out, to be made here between relative and absolute. Now the problem is, you see, though, is when we think all there is the relative, and most of us are there, even the absolutists are there. They're completely, they don't know that. They think there's an absolute, but the absolute that they're grasping is just another relative idea. Maybe it's a thing. Maybe they got some holy rock or bowl or something. Okay. Probably aren't too many people like that around now today, but when it starts to become something more abstract, we'll say God or something like this. Something unseen, but there it is. But in principle, there is this absolute, and there's these absolute, you know. What we don't understand, or when people get caught in that way, what they don't understand is that, well, yes, you're saying there's something absolute, and you're probably feeling that, and for good reasons too, because there is. So it's probably coming out of some deep feeling that you have, but the problem is then you go and take hold of something, or you invent something, or you throw a word on it. But next thing you know, it's got attributes, and next thing you know, there's something else beside it that it's got to contend with. We can put the word on, that's the good, and then, you know, so then the other stuff is what? The bad, the evil, you know. What we don't understand is that that is not absolute, you see. Absolute doesn't look like that. It doesn't look like anything that you can get hold of at all. Any idea that you might have, that's not absolute. Any concept you have of something that's wrapped in its own skin, cut off and separate from everything, that's not absolute. So you see, the people who are buying into the absolute, this is the absolute law, we must all follow it. If you don't, you're evil, you're against God or whatever else. And if you can't convert, we got to kill you, or, you know, on and on like that. Well, what they don't understand, and like I said, this could be coming from a deep feeling, because I think we all do actually sense there's something genuine, real, and true in the world. Though it might be buried in a lot of us, buried under so much confusion, we're not aware of it. But for some of us, it can come springing out enough that we continue, but without waking up, without enlightenment, we don't understand what this is, and we end up doing all these foolish things that will just get us embroiled in more fights and arguments. So, well, what is this absolute then? And what is this distinction that can be made between relative and absolute? It is that when we look at this world as a whole, everything is showing up here as this and that. But every time we try to get hold of any one of these this and that, even ones that we will label, hey, well, this is the absolute over here, though, we have to realize that can't be the absolute, because it's in relation to some. If it's in relation to something else, well, then it's not absolute. There's God out there, and God is supposedly absolute, and somehow you relate to God, but then God's also relating to you, and that's a relation, and that's not absolute, is it? That's called relative. It is very simple. And if we were to just see that, digest that, take it in, and understand that that is always the situation. Always the situation. And I just gave you a hint that we're never out of this. That within this relative, we find the absolute. It is in the wholeness, the completeness of this, that absolute reality has this nature to it. That it always appears as this and that. But the this and that's that are appearing here are never it. Tongshan, great Chinese Zen master in our lineage. Tongshan, crossing the bridge one day, it's in his Song of Ju Mer Awareness, crossing the bridge, looks down and sees his reflection and wakes up. Tongshan, who then said, "You are not it. It actually is you. You're not the absolute. The absolute, though, manifests as just this. There you are." And he saw this. And what's this about this distinction between the absolute? Are we saying that the absolute then is the relative and the relative is the absolute? Well, you see, we can't really say that, can we? Because clearly absolute is not relative. As I just pointed out, if we have the absolute sitting out there and you enter into relationship with it, it's not absolute. So absolute can't be something like that. Absolute is in all of this here. Well, then how is that exactly? Well, you see, every time we try to get hold of that, it just becomes some object, some idea that we have, something that we can now believe or hold up. Well, this is the truth, brother or sister. You should all come around to this. Well, we're back in the relative again, you see. But it is always like this. It's always this situation. This never changes. This is how it is. So you are not it. Nothing you can get hold of is it. But it actually is all of this that is manifesting here. And were we to see this, we would act in a radically different way. We would not act like a fool who thinks, "Oh, I've got a corner on the truth here. This is my truth. This is how it is, and you should all believe it, and we're going to ram it through, and you all have to become..." No, that's just the same old stuff that as human beings we get embroiled in and caught up in and clinging to. And it isn't in the sorrowful other side that says, "Well, there's stuff, you know, it's all..." It doesn't matter. It's all relative. The truth is according to what we say it is. Scientific reports coming in, no, but that doesn't match our politics here. Let's just rewrite those reports. Doesn't matter anyway, you know. So let's just do that. There we are. Were we to see this and to realize this right here within yourself, and to realize there's no distinction between this and any of that out there, because this is this absolute aspect, and yet it shows up as this and that. Now, we take care of this and that as our own life, because it is. What is your life apart from this and that? Nothing. There's no such thing as that. It's a radically different orientation. And now, this, though we never speak of it in terms of this word honor, but there it is. What are we talking about? Well, we're talking about there's something deep in the heart and mind that if we see this, if we realize this, we don't violate it. And we don't violate it because, well, I want to look good, or because Big Brother's watching, or God, or whoever else. I'll be good so that I can get some kind of reward. None of that kind of thinking is just gone. That's just more grasping, just operating out of our usual selfish ego. So we have this kind of a sense. Though, as I said, it's often spoken more of as in terms of shame than in terms of honor. Well, if we have a sense of this honor, a sense of shame, well, then it keeps us from doing dishonorable things, shameful things. And there's all kinds of stories and examples that we find in Zen and in Buddhism of this virtue, of this sense. What I tried to give you this morning is the depth out of which this is coming. This kind of understanding. And you have to realize that to the extent you remain caught in your own little self, your own little ego, as much as we do that because we want to be happy and pleased and always protecting ourselves, there, you betcha. We'll do it for those motives, but what we don't understand is that it keeps us embroiled in suffering and in confusion, and we never arrive at that satisfaction. That if we were to just forget this little self here, I don't mean forget in the sense of starting to neglect or, you know, start, you know, begin to starve and all that. No. But just take care of it as, take care of everything. Or vice versa. Just take care of this moment. It's an easy life to live. It is a sane life. It is a just life. And it is an honorable life. Then we can begin to walk this path. But it shows up in all kinds of ways. There's a story I've given before of the fellow who comes in. He's been studying Zen now for about 10 years or so. And he thinks that, well, maybe now I'm ready to become a teacher myself. And that's the one when it's raining. So he comes in to see the teacher. And because it's raining, the teacher asked him, he says, out there in the vestibule, did you leave your umbrella to the right or left of your clogs? And he couldn't remember. He wasn't paying attention. So he had a sense of honor, a sense of shame. And he realized he wasn't ready to be a teacher. And he continued to study for another 8 years. You know. Well, here we have another case. There's many stories like that. Here we have another case. Kasan Sweat. Kasan was asked to officiate at the funeral of a provincial lord. He had never met lords and nobles before, so he was nervous. When the ceremony started, Kasan Sweat. Afterwards, when he had returned, he gathered his pupils together. Kasan confessed that he was not yet qualified to be a teacher, for he lacked the sameness of bearing in the world of fame that he possessed in the secluded temple. Then Kasan resigned and became the pupil of another teacher. 8 years later, he returned to his former pupils, enlightened. Well, that's another story. And there are others, many others like that. If you don't notice this in Zen training, or maybe you have noticed it, but you don't take it to heart. But you have to realize, if you are interested in waking up, you can't set this aside. It is just like that. This has to be your heart. Take care of each moment and what it is that you can do in this moment. You got designs on becoming a Buddha or a hotshot teacher or something like that? You're going to have to set that aside. If that is your heart, isn't going to go anywhere. And you're going to cause a great deal of damage by leading all sorts of people astray. And I understand, too, and this is why I started out, by just pointing out how pervasive it is in our culture among people very high standing, yet having no sense of honor. And so we might have the idea that it's okay to be that way. There was a young man who wanted to be a teacher. But he lied. The point-blank lie comes out, and I pointed out the lie. No sense of shame, no sense of embarrassment, just flat affect, nothing. But I can understand how someone can be that way in our culture today, because we see it all around us. That people can be dishonest, they can lie, they can do whatever they need to do to get ahead. And yeah, maybe you want to be this or you want to be that because it looks good or whatever. You want to stand out in some particular way. But if that's your heart, you have to understand that you do not understand this teaching. So how can you carry it out? And of course, many people do in one way or another, just in a large shakeout of the world, end up being in positions where ostensibly they're teaching this, and yet don't understand it. The understanding comes in living it out. If you don't understand it, you don't live it out. And you might think that it's okay that you can lie. You can lie to your teacher, and it doesn't matter. You think, well, you can get away with that, I can get away with this. Well, yeah, maybe you can. But you should ask yourself, what do you want here? To exchange your enlightenment for any position at all, I don't care what it is. Is not worth it. You shouldn't set that aside for anything. But you should realize what that is. And cultivate that within you, that sense of honor. And it shows up in all kinds of small ways. You sign up for Tea Treat, well then by golly, you follow it through. You follow it through or die trying, and I mean it. Oh, it's just a Tea Treat. Yeah, I know. Okay, yeah. Granted, there might be a time when maybe you can't follow through. That can happen. But it didn't happen because, I don't feel like it, or you don't take it seriously. This is life and death we're speaking, because the absolute is right in that. It isn't just the relative. The absolute is always present here. And while the relative is always very showy, and we can notice when things are done or not done or whatever else, the absolute goes on very quietly, and too much time we maybe not really notice, because nothing very spectacular ever shows up. But quietly, you know, it's like the atmosphere. Something vital is being drained away. We have leaders now who other leaders can't trust their word. I mean, there's something vital that's just been lost, something precious that's just lost. But we don't notice. It is like the atmosphere. It's kind of, you know, we don't notice the atmosphere. And yet if the atmosphere drained away, that's it. For us, it's vital. But we don't notice it. You know, we have a cup. We look inside, it's empty. But it's not empty. Of course, the atmosphere is in there. See? But it's that sort of thing. We don't know what the absolute is, what we're mindful of here in terms of this is this wholeness, this totality in which it is all taking place. And you violate it a little bit here, okay, maybe that doesn't show. You do it again here a little bit and that doesn't show. But pretty soon things start to decay and fall apart. And all the while, you know, the quality of your mind is being corrupted and compromised, embroiled in more confusion and pain and suffering. So that's what is so difficult about this way, about finding the Buddha way. Because we are so drawn to the graspable, the thing that we can get hold of, the thing that we can hold up there as a sign or a placard or a badge or a certificate. That's easy for us. you take your vow as a monk and you can slap on the robes and you look pretty fancy. I don't slap on the robes anymore because, I do still wear this little thing here, but because it's a gimmick, really. And people get sidetracked by all the wrong things. What it is that we are opening our mind to is something that's very quiet and pervasive. We can't get hold of it. It isn't a particular thing. It doesn't exist in relationship to anything. But there it is. And I've said before that enlightenment, with the seeing of enlightenment, this is the dropping away of our delusions, or just simply the seeing through the illusory nature of that which is showing up here, which isn't a derogatory thing or a dismissive thing, by the way, and that's also important to understand. I've talked about that elsewhere, but I have to remind you of that. But enlightenment is nothing more than seeing that, seeing the empty nature of that. Not the nothingness nature of it. There is not nothing. You can't dismiss it. But the empty nature of it. So enlightenment is kind of a general eye, not an eye of particulars. Just seeing and understanding, realizing how it is that the Absolute is right here. And we don't need to resort to some designated thing, some wrapped up thing with a name on it, to be our Absolute. There is no such thing as that, by its very nature that it's separate. It's right on the face. There it is. There's your all defeating argument right there. Simple as that. But then we go to the other extreme and think there's nothing. No, that's not the case. This is what we have to awaken to. This is what Nagarjuna was pointing out for us. That if we don't understand this distinction, then we don't understand the Buddha's message, he said. All right, well, maybe I said enough this morning. Do you have any comments on anything I said today? Or maybe I should ask questions. Keep your comments to yourself. Yes.
Right, we discussed this student why directly to you, and it seemed to imply that you should go elsewhere.
No, but I have no control over that. Best would be to fess up. I mean, you're caught in a point blank lie. There was no wiggle room. It was just plain false. Okay, now there's only two things left for you. And I'm afraid I think he chose the wrong one. I'm very sad to see that. But of course, the story's not over. I don't know. I won't send anybody away. And I didn't send anybody away. The only recourse is to stay there. And it doesn't have to be with a teacher like that. It could be in any situation where you're caught in a falsehood, in something fake, something phony. Then at that point, you have to be honest. You know, there's no choice in the matter. Because this is where Absolute is showing up, is in this kind of a matter. But it's not a particular thing. But this is the situation. If you're going to continue on in deceit, or we'll ignore that, or we'll go on, well, then that's what it is. But you see, that isn't what this way is. This way is about the next moment you get right back on the path and let's continue to walk. This is where the misuse of shame would be. We think, you know, shame on you, bad, bad. But we never say that. It's not shame on you. It's not for anyone else to say that. But it would be shame rising up out of your own heart and mind here. If what you're really interested in is awakening, then you get right back on this path again. If an apology is in order, then offer it. You make amends in some way, well, then take care of that and stop living in guilt or anything else. Meaning things like pretending it never happened, just ignoring it. That's the situation. The choice is stark. If you want to awaken, there's only one way to take care of this. Or we continue in our usual way, trying to buffer the ego, trying to make it feel better. I would say, never, just set all that aside, because isn't it what you want is to be awake? Do you understand what that means? You can't be fooling around with this. No wiggle room here. And this matter about honesty and honor and shame is only one aspect of all of this. There's many other aspects to this too. But this is certainly a big one. And this is something you need to recognize within your own heart. And never mind what other people are thinking, how they are living, how they are carrying on, or this or that, or whatever. It is for each one of us. Look at your own heart and mind. This is where we awaken. It has nothing to do with anyone else. When someone comes to me and lies, okay, maybe there's something I could say or do there, but not a whole in the end. It's their life, their decision. I can't choose for them. I won't go chasing after, pleading, begging. I won't drive anyone away. None of that. Wu-wei, you know, wu-wei. Hands off. It's not my business. My business is, as it is with your business, really, too, but I can't speak for it. My business is in each moment live out of awakening. Sometimes when I sit down to talk, people show up. Well, then I'll say as best I can something that's on my mind regarding all of this. I'll give it my best. Sometimes it's not so good. But that's it. And just continue to watch my mind and to continue to practice. And it's actually a joyful life. I wouldn't trade it for anything. It was very simple. There was a time when I was full of ambition to do all sorts of other things, but well, whatever happiness I would hope to gain through that, I've long given up on that. Well, anyway, I'm rambling on here. Yes?
It reminds me of these situations you have where you sense what the right thing to do is, but you can never justify it by saying, well, it's because of applying this rule or that rule.
Yeah, that's a good point. And don't justify it. Because the moment you justify it, you begin to pull it back down into the relative again. Do you have a sense of that? Then act out of that. Later, if you reflect on it, you might realize, if you truly are acting out of the wholeness there, you might realize that you weren't acting now out of ego. And in the end, it actually feels better than if you were trying to act out of some particular idea or justification that you have for it. That never feels good. I always end up feeling like I'm lying if I try to justify why I said or did things, but I'm often forced into it. And sometimes you want to know, why did you do that? Maybe I can say something, but really, you don't know. I don't know. So just keep it in the general. Basically, it's more a matter of learning to avoid doing something that's just going to form that ego a little tighter, you know. Just stay away from that. As much as we think we'll get happiness that way, you don't. You get misery that way. Once you really realize that, it's a lot easier. Yeah. So I would say don't worry about the justification or any of that. Yeah, Peter, do you have something too?
It sort of ties in with the idea of integrity or wholeness as opposed to being divided. Everyone in this country today is divided in so many ways. It just sort of weakens your integrity.
Yeah, well, of course, all those divisions are taking place in our mind. Things are really not that clearly divided. You know, like we divide the United States from Canada, but you go up there, you tell me. Maybe we put a fence there or something, yeah, okay. But I look at the clouds and the birds. You know, these divisions that we'll put there, they come out of our mind. Out of our doing. And sometimes they're functional and useful. Like, well, maybe it is useful to have a line here between the United States and Canada. Okay. It helps to function as governments and societies and whatever. Yeah. But pretty soon that can... I hope it never happens between the United States and Canada, but sometimes those lines can become severe. Armies go across. But that's something artificial. That's something we create. Out of our own carelessness and not paying careful attention to how things actually are. That in the absolute sense, really nothing is separate and divided in that way. You cause damage over there, Right now, I just heard some people talking about, yes, we attack Iran. And then it's kind of like, it reminded me of somebody playing chess, an inexperienced chess player. You ever play chess? You know, I'm not a very good chess, I'm a lousy chess player, but I know that a very good chess player, you're seeing 8, 9, 10 moves ahead. To me, it's incomprehensible because every move, all the different possibilities keep increasing. Oh, anyone can do this beyond me, but a very unskilled chess player, you say, oh, well, I can do this, but you don't realize all the ramifications. Because you made that move, the board looks different now. And you can take this out, but you think the opponent's just going to sit there and let that happen? But I've heard people talking about their war strategies. Well, we can just do this, and the world stays just like it is today. And we've done that, and there we are. And now maybe we can do this, but we forget that in the meantime, other things are happening. My point is that, we think we can just lob something across that line, but there's really no line there. And what's happening over there is affecting things happening here. And it's continuous and ongoing. If you were to awaken to this, you will start to move in the direction of wu-wei. You just lay off. Start paying attention to your own heart and mind. And what do you think you're going to get out of this anyway? I'll tell you, it's going to be nothing but woe and sorrow unless you lay off. Now let's see if we can work together, recognizing that we're all in this big hole here together. Hole with a W. Or we'll be in a big hole with just an H, I guess. Okay, well, it looks like I've gone over here. Did you have something there, Jonas?
Yeah. How would you recommend that someone finds forgiveness for their dishonors?
That's not their business. If I dishonor you in some way, or if, it's not my business that you forgive me. I shouldn't even really expect it. That's your business, though. If somebody wrongs me, it's my business if I forgive them. It's not their business. So once again, we're constantly reaching and trying to control that other out there. And this is what I expect from you. I apologize and I feel really bad. Can't you forgive me? That would be nice, yes. But that's really not your business. It's enough for us just to really... There's a horrible line in Scrooge where he says it's enough for a man to know his own business, but he meant it in a radically different way than I. But it is enough for you to just, in this case, just know what your business is. And your business is not in controlling others or telling them what they should think or do. And it's like right here. You might think that I'm telling you what you should think or do. I'm not. I have no control over what you do. You come and listen. I'm going to say these things. You can take it or leave it. It's like in writing my books. That's what's kind of nice about writing. But you can write a book and it just sits there. People could either pick it up and read it or not. Go buy it, whatever. My publisher would like me to trot around and try to sell it and stuff like that, you see. This time around, fortunately, they laid off and I didn't have to go... trotting off. What I'm saying is that you can offer things, you can put things out there, but whether or not anybody else accepts it is really not your business. I'll sit down here, I'll give a talk, people show up. If after a while, if nobody was showing up, I wouldn't come in here, sit down and talk. And I also wouldn't go running after you asking, oh, would you please come and listen to me? If I did that, it wouldn't be worth coming in to listen to me. So this is something we need to reflect on and learn to attend to really what is yours to do. We always tend to look out there and we're not paying attention right here. And the place where we are paying attention here, me, aggrandizing me, that's the part where you forget that part. And now reverse that. Now why don't you try to help someone else? Consider them. In the way that you might otherwise selfishly think of yourself. Forget yourself in that regard. But in the place where we really should be paying attention to ourselves, we tend not to. We're really concerned about all of them out there. So we've got these two areas. There's two areas and they're both reversed. Spot those and see if you can find them. Become acquainted with them and catch yourself when you're acting out of that, either one of them, in an unhealthy way. Well, we really have gone over. If you had another point, Jonas, you can bring it up later, but I should end it here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.